It's 8:10 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Utah Legislature's Tax Restructuring and Equalization Task Force met for 5 hours Tuesday to debate tax reform, policy recommendations, and take public comment. Joining me now in the studio to take a look at what's on the table, I have House Minority Leader Brian King, along with Representative Tim Quinn. Thanks you both for being here this morning. Great
Thank
to see you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Tim, you have said all along that every option is on the table. Now we know what options the task force chairs, Senator Lyle Hilliard and House Majority Leader Francis Gibson, are most interested in pursuing. One recommendation in particular, though, that you have opposed all along is restoring the full sales tax on food. Given that this was something that you had taken on alone in the beginning, I mean, how did this come to be such a serious proposal?
That's a good question. I think that this has been led by the Senate. The Senate, I think Brian would agree, the Senate has always wanted to restore the sales tax on food. Most of my House colleagues are opposed to it, but it wound up, and we were not part of the chair's proposals. It was just the chairs working that out. So how it actually got in there, I'm not certain, but it is what's there now. I may try to amend that in our next meeting to see if we could add more services to the tax base and remove the sales tax on food altogether, but I'm just one voice out of 10 on that committee, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, how do you feel about the sales tax on food, Brian, being restored?
Well, we think it's the most efficient way of making sure that you address the needs of food insecure people or people who risk being food insecure is to lower the sales tax to zero on food. Not prepared food, I mean not restaurant food, but food that is unprepared, food that people need to really make ends meet. So I'm with Tim on this in the sense that I think it's a bad idea to increase it. I think it would be better to go to zero. Of course, right now it's at 1.75% rather than 4.75%. But we'll work with him and other like-minded Republicans, the Democrats, I think, to keep it at 1.75. I think all the Democrats are on the same page on this.
Yeah. How would this, by increasing the sales tax on food, solve the state's tax problem here?
Well, I don't think that in and of itself would solve the problem. It would increase revenue by $250 million in the total. If the grocery tax credit goes into place, then that reduces it to, I think, just a little over $100 million that we would actually take in. So it's part of the larger proposal, but I still think that it could be done a different way. When I first started this, you mentioned I started this alone. When I first started this 18 months ago, the reason we were looking at it is because our spending habits have changed. In no other area have they changed as much as they've changed in food purchases. We're down 71% in the last 70 years in the amount of unprepared food that we buy because we eat out more. So I told the committee we're kind of hanging our hat on something that is a diminishing return. So while I think it's a Band-Aid, it's a large Band-Aid, but we're going to have to revisit this, or somebody's going to have to revisit this 5, 7, 10 years down the road because food continues to decline like other goods do.
Yeah, but the growth in population increases.
It does, but yet still the amount of food, unprepared food that we buy has diminished 71% over the last seven decades.
Yeah. Other policy considerations include increasing the gas tax, expanding the sales tax, while at the same time lowering the income tax. And I think we all understand that lowering the income tax disproportionately benefits the wealthy, while raising taxes on those everyday needs disproportionately hurts the poor. So how do we explain that?
Well, that's a great question, and that's one of the things that we as Democrats have been concerned about. I'm concerned about that. The other aspect of it, Leslie, as you know, is that all of our income tax money in the state of Utah is designated to be used for public and higher education. So if you want to decrease the state income tax and decrease the revenue that comes from that source, what you're saying is we have a lower amount of money that is explicitly designated for public and higher education. That's a concern, too, for a state that's 51st in the country in terms of per pupil spending.
Tim, would you like to respond to that?
As far as the disproportionate benefit to the wealthy versus the lower income, if you look at the incidence of tax, which the LFA legislative fiscal analysts have spent a lot of time doing, it's pretty proportionate in terms of percentages for those benefits to the wealthy as well as to the low income. Because of the grocery tax credit and because of the child exemption that's been put back in that the federal reforms of December 2017 took away from us, if you look at it from an incidence of tax, the lower income benefit just as much on a percentage basis as do the wealthy.
One of the recommendations is to remove the constitutional earmark on income tax for education. This would require, however, a vote of all Utah residents and then two-thirds of the state legislature approving it. Brian, let me ask you first. If removing this earmark on income tax for education was successful, how is it that we ensure that we're spending enough money on education?
That's the question, I think, that people who have some sympathy for the idea that the restriction puts too much of a handcuffs the legislature too much. That's our question. I am sympathetic to the idea that earmarks in our budgeting process have made it difficult for us at times to fund what we want to fund. And Representative Quinn, of course, has been working on this for the last year too. But the concern that I have is I think that there are different things that you can do rather than decreasing the amount of money that goes to public education. Constitutionally, right now, we have a certain amount that goes to public education, and people feel that that's a secure source of income. If you want to take that away, you've got to come up with something that makes those who are in the education community and concerned about public education feel secure that they're going to have an alternative source. You could do that statutorily. I've heard things like requiring that the legislature pass by two-thirds margins as law any decrease in the funding for public education below some sort of a floor, like, you know, tie it to rates of inflation or student growth or rates of school spending in other states. And so, you know, you can get creative here, but if you give up that income tax earmark in the Constitution, you're giving up an awful lot.
Tim, the governor this week at his monthly news conference said he would support the removal of the constitutional guarantee if we can find buy-in from the educational stakeholders and that they can show that there is going to be a sustainable revenue stream for education. Do you think we've done that?
There's kind of a three-legged stool as far as stakeholders in education. Two of those three are on board, I believe, and maybe that's a stronger statement than it needs to be made, but So that's in the works.
Those being, who are those three stools?
If you look at the UEA as one leg, the superintendents as another, and the state board as a third. I think there are ways. You know, we use the example in the task force, at least one representative did, in our household budgets. We might have a certain amount allotted for housing, a certain amount allotted for utilities, a certain amount for food, for clothing, for entertainment, for a vacation. And if one of those gets out of whack, if our electricity bill is higher than we thought, we have the ability as a household, so I need to take some of that money from my entertainment fund and pay my electricity bill. We don't have that flexibility in the state legislature because of that earmark. I think earmarks in general are a bad idea. Now, when I was meeting with the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce and these working groups, education was the last one. And when I brought this up about removing the earmark, I suggested, though, that we have some type of floor based on historical data of what we have spent as a percentage of the entire state budget. What we've spent in the past, let's set that as some type of floor so that we can never go below that. And in good years, we increase it. And in bad years, we still don't go below that floor that we've set. So I think there are some mechanisms we can put in place to make the education system feel safe and secure. Because right now, while, yes, there's this mental security blanket with the constitutional earmark, as legislature, we could literally take the income tax rate to zero if we wanted. Now, that would be foolish, but we could. So in reality, there is no real security blanket for the education system. If we had some statutorily mandated minimum, I think that would be a better way to do it.
So, I mean, we're talking about having a special session and kind of moving this along. Given the unknown of this component of it, do we not need to wait until that's been decided to go forward with this plan?
Well, as far as a special session, that remains to be seen. I know that it is the desire so that if we do a tax cut, that it will take effect January 1st of 2020. I think that's the main reason for a special session, but that's not been set. We, to be honest with you, back in March 14th or 13th when we passed this bill to create the task force, I thought we would be much further along this process than we are. We're here at the latter part of October. Whether we have a special session in December or not, I think is still up in the air.
And one of the things, Leslie, about that, about whether we're going to have a special session is, one of the things I think we got into a problem with, and Tim knows as well or better than I do, in the last session is that the House had its own ideas and the Senate was never on board. So what you've got to do is get the two chambers on the same page. And I think Representative Quinn has been talking about the fact that the Senate are the one, the senators are the ones who like this idea of increasing the sales tax on food. That's an example of the kind of compromise that you see at the legislature, where in an effort to bring both chambers in line, some, you know, it's you get this and I'll take that kind of a thing. And that's what we're looking at. And I'm not sure that we're going to get to a point where we have a special session, simply because I'm not sure that we're going to all get on the same page in terms of the two chambers. Maybe we will, but it wouldn't surprise me if we didn't.
Yeah, we really don't have, I mean, what, 3-4 weeks before things really start getting busy, and then nobody's got time to do anything.
Yeah, I think once you get past the first weekend, or maybe second week at latest in December, it's not, nothing's going to happen until a session.
Yeah. But again, so when we went back to that stool, you'd mentioned the superintendents, the State Board of Education, and the Utah Education Association. Is that where you need buy-in from? I'm kind of looking at a post here from Heidi Matthews, president of the UEA, and she's like, that's the rub, you know.
Right.
There needs to be that sustainable source.
And we had some of the superintendents actually worked closely with me last year on HB 441, which was kind of the genesis of this. So, yeah, we need to get all three on board in some fashion and make sure that everyone is comfortable. It doesn't mean everyone is going to be happy, but everyone needs to be comfortable with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, moving forward, I mean, what if this is not, this earmark is not approved by state residents, then what?
Well, then you go back, and the fallback is the situation that we have right now with the earmark being maintained. And that's why it's important. If you don't get the education community, all components of the education community on board, it's not going to be that difficult for them, given the concerns that we already have about education spending in the state of Utah. It's not going to be that difficult to, I think, get the people of the state of Utah to say, nah, you rethink this at the legislature. You mentioned the way that the vote has to go earlier, Leslie. The first votes that will take place, that have to take place before it gets to the ballot, is 2/3 of the House and 2/3 of the Senate have to approve it. The governor signs off on it, and then it goes to the people on the general ballot in a general election.
But even if this bill is going to be into 2 or 3 parts, I left early from the tax meeting Tuesday, had an obligation at the National Ability Center at their ribbon cutting ceremony. But it was my understanding there were 3 bill files open. One is the tax reform. The second is the earmark, so that they are separate and individual. So if we pass both of them in the House and Senate, like Representative King just talked about, but the public on the ballot fails to pass the constitutional amendment, we still have the restructuring in place where we've shifted the imbalance that I think we've, and I think most people agree that we have now. The latest numbers that came out, the general fund is down $43 million. We're in the hole, $43 million in the general fund. So we have to do something.
Which is primarily from sales tax,
right,
Leslie. Not exclusively from sales tax, but primarily
vast majority.
Sales tax.
Vast majority.
So the state already has a problem, some would say, funding services through the general fund, especially for the social services and our infrastructure needs. The combined income tax cut and sales tax increases are predicted to cost the state $75 million in revenue. So how do we pencil that out for the funding those services that are currently unfunded? And as you mentioned, we're at 43 already. But
well, and that's my concern. Our concern as Democrats, I think, is that that tax cut, the Republican leadership, the Speaker and the President and the chair, co-chairs of the task force right now, have really made it clear that they want to see a tax cut. And yet the tax cutting will come primarily, if not exclusively, from a reduction in income tax rates, which means it's coming out of public and higher education. That really gives us some heartburn. We saw this back in 2008 with the single rate tax system we put in place. Then we put in place a tax cut of $250 million in income tax each and every year, straight out of the hide of public education and higher education. We just can't keep doing this and then be concerned about the performance of our kids and how good a quality education our kids are receiving.
Tim, would you like to respond?
I would just say, and I sitting next to Representative King, I hate to disagree with him, but it's one of the fun enjoyments of the legislature to disagree with him. He knows that's not true. When the tax cut was implemented in 2007, 2008, the income tax, if you go back this entire century, starting in the year 2000, and you look to today, state revenues have never been higher on a per capita basis. So we have some empirical data that shows if we lower income tax rates to a degree, and you can't lower them to zero. That argument doesn't hold always. But if you do lower the income tax rates and spur the economy, you can actually increase revenue, even in the income tax side, even though you lowered rates to each of the individuals because you spur activity. So What that number is, what that equilibrium is, I'm not certain. But when we did lower them, it did increase revenue. And that's why we had $1 billion almost exclusively surplused in the income tax side this past year.
Well, Tim has outlined supply side economics to the T. And it's true that there are circumstances where if you decrease the tax rate, you may stimulate activity to actually increase revenue. But I don't think there's much data to suggest that our single rate that we adopted in 2008 has done that. The reality is we've gone through a long economic boom, not just in Utah, but in this entire country, that has resulted in greater revenue. And that's a great thing. We love it. But I don't believe that we have solid data to show that the reduction in income tax in 2008 has resulted in increased rather than decreased revenue.
Again, Tim, people speaking out against the policy proposals include the advocacy organizations for low-income Utahns. So what does that say about the proposals? I mean, if they're the ones showing up at these
meetings. Well, there's a lot of groups that are showing up to these town halls and to these tax reform task force meetings, not just the advocates. But I've spent a lot of time meeting with them individually. They've come to my office in Lehigh. I've met with them at the Capitol. I've visited with them over the phone many, many times because I think they recognize I ran a bill in 2018 in the House that passed, did not pass the Senate, to remove the sales tax on food completely. So they know my stance on that. They know that I have a soft spot in my heart for that segment of society. So I've been working with them, and I told them last time I met with some of them, I said, look, sometimes the die has been cast, and food sales tax on food may be a reality because of the desires of the Senate. So if it is, then let's make sure that we do the best we can with that potential outcome, meaning we get the highest tax credit we can with the highest level of income threshold that we can. And I think if you look at the tax credit, and I'm not suggesting that I'm in favor of it, but looking at the sales tax on food, I think we've done a fairly good job of making sure that those who need protection have protection. And in many of those income brackets, depending upon the number of dependents you have, you could actually, this is not going to sound right, but you could actually make a little bit of money because of that $100 per person tax credit for groceries. I've done the calculations, and people would have to be spending at a $35,000, $40,000 a year income if they had two children. They would spend $10,000 a year on food in order to lose money versus the credit. So it will be a tax cut to them as well. So we'll see where it all comes out.
Here's my concern about that, Leslie. Right now, the most immediate way that you have of delivering relief to people who are insecure with food and is to just cut the rate down to zero, or at least leave it at 1.75 as it is right now. The alternative that we're talking about in the co-chair's proposal is to increase the rate to 4.75 and give this tax credit that Representative Quinn's referred to. The tax credit comes, though, only to people who file state income tax. And a disproportionate number of people who are on the low end of the income spectrum, they don't file at all. If you're making $10,000 or $15,000 a year, you think to yourself, I got no income to report, and they'd be right. And so, you know, when you have a significant number of people who never file and never have access to the tax credit, that's a problem. The other problem is the tax credit comes in a lump sum at one time during the year as opposed to being spread along across all your purchases for food throughout the year. That's an inefficient way of delivering economic relief.
There are some talks about putting that credit up front, though, so that it's not back-end loaded. And make sure we understand, too, this is a refundable credit, meaning if you don't owe the taxes, you still get the credit. It's not just a credit on taxes you owe.
But you still have to file a tax return.
Why do you keep saying but to me?
Well, I guess what I think what's really one of the most concerning things is you mentioned, you know, how many more people are eating out and eating food that's not good for them. And they're doing so because you can get a hamburger for a buck, or, you know, three roast beef sandwiches for $5.
Not
bucks.
A good hamburger for a buck.
We know exactly, but that's where people are going. Right. One, yeah. Because they're working three jobs and don't have the time to go grocery shopping, much less feed.
No, you're absolutely,
you know,
right.
Prepare the food.
Fast food. The fast in fast food means that it's more attractive to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford it. And it's not the most nutritious stuff in the world. You're right.
Well, I just think that that's, we're going to pay for it one way or another. So if it's not, we won't go there. What's next from here? I mean, do the proposals need to go to a legislative committee after this?
We will go back to a task force meeting, I believe, November 5th or 7th.
I thought it was the 7th.
Could be the
7th. 7th and 21st,
and
I think.
21st. And if we can pass that out of the task force, then it will go to the combined interim rev and tax, Senate and House rev and tax committee. And if it passes that, then it will go to either a special session or next year's general session.
Right. Any more public hearings on this?
Yes.
Just before of all
those.
Of these committees?
Yeah, the 7th and the 21st are public hearings. But, you know, no action will be taken in terms of us being able to do a special session until after November 21st. And as we were saying earlier, once you get to the end of the second week in December, I don't think anybody's interested in coming back for a special session. So we have a relatively narrow window here to act in which to act if we do act.
True.
All right. Before I let you go, can you talk to me about anything on your agenda, Tim, in terms of
this is my agenda.
Session?
This is how I spent my summer, is working on tax reform. So I know a lot of representatives and senators have 10, 15, 20 bill files open. I don't have any right now because this is what I've been concentrated on.
Okay. If people would like to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
My phone number, 801-830-5765.
Okay. Does that take texts? Text
yes,
messages?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I thought you said, does that take a tax?
Oh, yeah.
that was a cruel
tax
question.
Tax on the brain.
And Brian, anything on your agenda outside of this?
Yeah, we are working on New Mexico passed a background check bill in their session earlier this year. I've taken that bill, asked our legislative fiscal analyst's office to draft something that reflects it with some Utah angles to it, and they've put that together, and I'm talking with people behind the scenes right now. I anticipate within the next two or three weeks to unveil that publicly, but I think what Utahns want and what Americans want are common sense background checks, and I think we can have that on the purchase of guns in a way that will make it less likely that people who shouldn't have guns get them. So or rather more likely that people that shouldn't have guns get them. I think I've still screwed that up in how I stated it. But I think you know what
people
I mean.
But you are Brian.
Guns.
People have shunned. People who shouldn't have guns don't get them. That's what we're trying to say.
What's your response to
that? I was going to say, we had a discussion here in Park City with Representative King about this background check bill. And depending upon how it's drafted, and he would say the same thing, I'm supportive of that. I hope Representative King runs a bill that he's ran the last two sessions, which we called kind of a Good Samaritan
bill. The 911 bill. We are going to run it.
I've been supportive of that against my own party. I've been supportive the last 2 years, and I hope he runs it again.
Yep, I am. And I think that we're going to be able to get it passed this year. So,
okay. Well, again, I appreciate both of you taking the time to be here with us this morning.
Thanks,
you,
Leslie.
Okay. How do people get a hold of you, Brian?
Thank you for that question. 801-560-0769 is my cell phone. Texts are the best way to get in touch with me, 801-560-0769. Call now. Operators are standing by.
Okay.
Wow.
Representative Brian King, Representative Tim Quinn again. Thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:34. Good morning. Well, earlier this month, Park City resident Rob Lee rolled his bike into the Atlantic Ocean, officially finishing the third and final stage of his world triathlon. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning to you, Rob, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me in again.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talked back in August, and this was before you were taking off on the bike trip, we talked about how the bike riding may not be the easiest part of the trip. You, of course, froze and exhausted yourself on Mount Everest in May. You were covered with jellyfish stings and a salt-swollen tongue and lips from your English Channel swim in July. And then you spent how many days on a bike seat?
39 days took me to get across the country. And, yeah, you nailed it. I think a lot of folks, including myself, thought that this would be kind of the easier portion of the triathlon. But I kind of went into it maybe a little overweight because of my weight from the English Channel. I didn't have very much bike training, and so it proved to be very difficult.
Yeah, and I think it was challenging because you started from the more mountainous sides, whereas if you had maybe started from Nantucket and came across, would it have been easier for you? Given that you would have been able to build up the muscles and maybe lose some of the weight?
Maybe. But then you'd be also going against the trade winds. So I was partly going west-east just because naturally that is the way it worked in my mind that I wanted to go, but also because generally I had a tailwind. Now, I would say that I didn't have as much tailwind as I was expecting, but I had plenty of headwind, and that's when it really got even more difficult. But if I would have started on the East Coast, I think that could have proved to be pretty difficult, and also I probably would have run into more weather later on when I was like going through Glacier and the North Cascades and whatnot.
Yeah. So what was the most challenging part of the bike ride?
Gosh, I think it was probably just how relentless it was. It was every day waking up, you know, an hour before sunrise and getting on the road pretty much at sunrise and knowing that I was going to be on the bike most of the day. You know, I rode about 100 miles every day. I had a couple of days that were less than that, and I certainly had some days that were more. I think my longest days were a little over 130 miles, but when you add in stops for, you know, refueling and to get more liquids and even to go to the bathroom and then maybe a lunch stop, I was basically on the bike like, you know, typically 7 to probably 9 or 10 hours a day. So it was just relentless. The other thing I would say is that the saddle sores were pretty bad, and that was, it was hard to get on the bike and be excited to be getting on the bike when it's not comfortable to be on the bike.
Yeah. Have you been on a bike since?
I have not. maybe at some point. I finally went for my first swim yesterday after, what is it, probably 3 months after the English Channel. So it takes a little bit, and then I start thinking about it, and I got in the pool yesterday, and it felt pretty good.
Yeah. Looking back of all of those three, I mean, what was the most challenging? And I guess one is maybe mentally, and I guess the second one would be physically.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I would probably say the bike was the hardest, and that's probably because it's the freshest in my mind. So maybe over time that that answer will change a little bit. But having just got off the bike and just knowing what that kind of took, I could have certainly slowed down and taken more days, and it did take a few more days than I was expecting from the start. I could have probably pushed a little bit harder, and I kind of decided along the way that I wanted to be able to enjoy it at least a little bit, stop. And as I said on my social media, you know, smell the flowers and take a couple photos and that kind of thing. But I was still moving pretty quick, and I did want to stop and like enjoy some of these places and have, you know, lunch in a fun cafe instead of just like having a PB&J on the road the entire time. So, yeah, at this point, I'd probably say the bike was the hardest portion, but we'll see how that goes over time.
Yeah. And so you had a lighter bike because you were spending nights in motels along the way. And what, had the support then from your wife and then your mom, and then Caroline came back?
Exactly. Yeah. So I was going to do it a little more self-supported, but after basically a week in the mountains, and my mother was very gracious. Caroline was with me, my wife, for the first, I think it was like 12 days, and she had some good work to do. She went to D.C. to talk to Congress and whatnot. So my mom graciously offered to come up and crew me. And so she crewed me for 12 days from like Whitefish, Montana to Minneapolis, and then Caroline joined me again. So yes, I was able to take some of the weight off my bike. And in all honesty, I was looking forward to kind of being on my own out there. But I had plenty of time on my own on the bike, but it was certainly nice to be able to meet someone for lunch or have someone there at the end of the day to go to dinner with and that kind of thing. So it was really great to have that support from them.
Yeah. So you were telling me before you left that you were going to probably be listening to some books and stuff. How many books did you actually listen to?
Gosh, I probably only listened to 2 or 3 books. I listened to lots of podcasts, and for some reason, I listened to a lot of the same music. I just had kind of 1 or 2 playlists that I listened to quite often. Maybe that's just where my brain goes with some of these kind of monotonous things, is I can just put on the music and then my mind goes elsewhere, but it, you know, keeps me going. So I listened to probably mostly music, then podcasts, and then a couple of books. Mm.
And I think I saw one post about one of the most harrowing parts of it was the traffic in, what, Jersey to New York? Or was there something that I missed? I mean, what was the...
Yeah, I mean, I would say that Newark, New Jersey was definitely pretty interesting to get through. There was a lot of traffic, but it was also, there weren't like bike paths or even shoulders. It was mostly like truck routes and industrial area that I was riding through. And then I ended up getting on this kind of like freeway with construction and yada yada. And it was one of those things where I went like, I'm not in the right place. And I put my bike over this kind of concrete barrier. Construction worker came up and he pointed me in the right direction with the traffic. But that was probably one of the more challenging kind of logistical areas to get through. Because certainly in the West, you're kind of on more scenic byways and going through the mountains. And it may be difficult riding as far as the elevation gain, but it was pretty straightforward. It was more when I got into the cities and some of those industrial areas that got kind of interesting.
Yeah. Any close calls?
Gosh, maybe on the second day, it wasn't necessarily any I didn't have any close calls with cars, even though there was definitely a lot of cars that kind of made me a little nervous, and they were a little closer than you want them to be. But on the second day, I just turned around to tell Caroline something. She was riding behind me, and I like kind of swerved and almost went off the road and almost ate it. And I kind of hit the guardrail and beat up my shoe a little bit and kind of hurt my ankle. And I was just going, gosh, I need to like make sure I'm paying attention to the road and what I'm doing here. So kind of funny that was like the second day.
Yeah. Following you along on social media, I think what I liked was just kind of your self-talk to each of the states that you kind of went through. And there were, I know, several times that you kind of mentioned, guy, I just blew through this state. And it's like you hope to go back to actually. So you saw something that I guess intrigued you enough to think that you would come back someday.
Yeah, I would say that about pretty much any of the places I went to. There was a lot of places that I went that I would not have seen if I was in a car. Even just driving back on the interstate was like a completely different experience. I think that goes without saying. But I went through a lot of small towns and saw some things that I thought were pretty cool. And I would say that when I was in some of these places, I thought, okay, I can see why someone who lives here would have pride in this place and would want to live here. And that's not necessary to say that I'm looking to go forward, or looking to go back to all these places, but there was a lot of really great places that I rode through.
Yeah. So after all is said and done, the last 6 months, I mean, was it worth it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely a sense of accomplishment there. I definitely want to keep having these conversations about the gender equality, and that's something that I kind of underestimate. I thought I was going to have more time to talk about that on the bike ride in particular, but I was just literally so tired every night that I didn't talk about that as much as I wanted to. So if anything kind of lives on after this, I think the Ultimate World Triathlon, which was made up anyway in my own mind, will kind of like fade, but I'd like to keep having those conversations about gender equality.
Yeah. So what kind of records did you set?
I don't know that I set any records. I mean, no one had swum the English Channel and climbed Everest in the same year. And that was like the first part of it. And so I was the first person to do that. And so if I was the first person to do that, I guess I was the first person to add this bike ride on as well. That's the only kind of sort of record that I guess I accomplished.
Yeah. And it was all done within 6 months, all three of the events?
Yep. Under 6 months and then add in the wedding.
Yeah. Right. And so is there some entry then in the Guinness World Book of Records somewhere? I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Honestly, I hadn't thought about it too much. I guess I can look into that, but this was all, it started as a kind of my own little project, and it's been nice to be here and talking to you and to other media outlets and whatnot, but this was always something that I just kind of wanted to do, and we'll see if it gets into any kind of like record book or something like that.
Yeah. So now what? I mean, life is probably kind of just boring, the same thing every day, showing up at work. And yeah.
You know, there's definitely an adjustment to get back to everyday life, but it certainly feels good to sleep in the same bed, in my own bed. You know, every night on the bike ride, I was in a different motel or hotel, and so it feels really good to be home. I'm literally probably going to do a lot of like home projects, I'm going to probably replace the poles on my kitchen cabinets. I mean, that's the next project, but there's always ideas out there that I'm looking to do, and I hope to go on some more adventures. But right now I'm just kind of trying to reflect on it and just enjoy it. So
I think at some point I recall you with the GoFundMe account, you were hoping to put together some kind of film. Is that in the works?
Yeah. So a sponsor of mine, Fat Tire Beer, is going to put together a short film. I think it's going to be like 2 or 3 minutes. But I'm also looking at options and looking for a producer and an editor to help me with something that would be a little longer, at something like 20 minutes. So again, I kind of just got home and I'm just getting back into the groove of things. I had to get back to work. I got to figure out a way to pay for this. The GoFundMe certainly helped, but I got to definitely get some more money in the bank account. So if you're looking to buy or sell a home, give me a call so that we can get some more funds in the bank account.
Yeah. So what's next for you? I mean, anything on the horizon?
Yeah. I mean, again, I don't have anything necessarily on the books, but I would love to. Actually, probably the first thing I need to think about is taking Caroline on a honeymoon. So we're going to figure that out, and we'll see if We'll probably just go to the beach somewhere, but I'd really love to go somewhere like Antarctica. I don't know that she wants to go there for our honeymoon, but we really want to go to Vincent Massif, the highest mountain in Antarctica, in Antarctica, and ski that. So whether that happens now or probably in a year or two or something like that, if we can raise the funds, that's kind of an expensive one there with the flights, but we'd love to go down to Antarctica.
Okay. Hey, Rob, again, congratulations. Pretty impressive.
Thank you very much.
Great.
Thanks for having me in. Yep.
That's Parkite Rob Lee. KPCW News Time now, 8:46. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, a group of men now known as MMAD, that's Men Making a Difference, have quietly been serving the Park City community since 2002. In the studio to tell me more about this nonprofit group, I have the vice president, Tom Savage. Good morning.
Good morning.
So do you say it? Is it just MMAD or is it MMAD or is there a way to say this?
Well, it has caught on as MMAD.
MMAD. Okay. So tell us a little bit about the group, who you are and what you do.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having us on the show. We really appreciate that. And what you do and what KPCW does here for causes such as this because of the communication challenges that are out there with, you know, especially people who are in need and they commonly follow there are human ways about trying to ask for help and we don't, or we don't get help, or we suffer, or we, you know, just don't know where to go. So that's what Men Making a Difference is about. We are a group of men, there's 55 or 60 men who meet on a regular basis off and on throughout the year. Some people still are here and helping. Some people have moved, but they help. We're really here this morning to look for people to help. We're not looking for money. We can always use the money, but we've got money. We're looking, and when I say we, Men Making a Difference was started by a group of men, as you mentioned earlier, some time ago, but it was formalized just recently and made a 501c3, and they include John Flanders, who's a well-known local individual here. He's not only local, he's a little crazy, but also is Jed Palmachi. And so Jed Palmachi is the president, and he came up with the idea of the Men Making a Difference and commonly works with a multitude of people here in the community, as does his wife, Bonnie. So that's the Palmachis, Jed and Bonnie. A lot of people out there listening right now know them, as they do know John and Luann Flanders. For example, Luann works at the Christian Center here in Park City on a volunteer basis, and John Flanders has supported a lot of local organizations. So we go out and we try to find people who need help and provide the kind of help that's being provided by other 501c3s, but for those people like widows and widowers and people in crisis that don't have some other source or resource to be served.
So what are some of the projects that you have done?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because this year we've done several projects. And for example, just this year we had let me just pick out one or two here. It was a lady who had no transportation. She had suddenly lost her job. She was a single mom, and she was really in a hard place between taking care of the kids and losing her job, doing some rehabilitation on her body because of an accident that was involved. And so we were able to provide transportation to her, a vehicle, help her at the home, and then try to help her get her back on her feet, which she now is, and she's doing great. So that was one. There's another one just recently with a person who's here. She's a single individual. She's a little older, about my age. Well, not quite that old. But she, being wheelchair-bound, wasn't able to really help take care of her place. While she could afford to do some of it and have it hired, one of our men found out about it and offered our services. So we went in and completely refurbished her, some of the trim, the doors and trims and garage and so forth at her home. And so she's very happy and thankful and has told us how full of joy she is when she drives in the driveway. So those are two examples.
Yeah. So is it that you do mostly sweat equity for people? Is that accurate, or is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's a good characterization, Leslie, because, you know, most of us have strong backs and weak minds, like me. But we go there. You know, you can throw money at a solution, and that's fine, and that's great, and that's what normally happens. But having people there one-on-one, having someone there who cares, someone who takes a personal interest in that individual and can, you know, enjoy sitting down and having a sandwich that person has fixed because you're out there moving their appliances or, you know, tearing down a fence or something like that and helping them to have a better life. People really enjoy that. So that's why we like to be personally involved, and sweat equity is a good way to put it.
Yeah. So you have the group, the men, the workers, to do projects. So what you're telling me is that you're looking for the people to help?
Yes. And when I've been thinking and praying about having this meeting with you, I thought about, well, how can we really touch the listeners to react, to take action? And I would hope and pray that the people who are listening to the program right now, when they hear of or know of now a need, that they would go to our website, that they would say, hey, I know these people, that they would inquire with us about how we may be able to help the listener, him or herself that's listening now, or someone they know. So our challenge here is to get the word out and then to fill the need as is appropriate.
All right. So what's the website then, if people, that way they could, there's an email address or something that people could send an email to do saying, hey, I need help, or this person could use some help?
Yes.
Okay. Is that the best way to do it then? What's the website?
The website is, do you have your pen and paper ready? Okay. Okay. So I'm shameless, absolutely shameless. So the website is MMAD, MM80, Men Making a Difference, now.org. So may I repeat that? Okay, repeat after me. No, I'm kidding. So it's mmadnow.org, mmadnow.org.
Okay, so there's a contact form then on the site.
Yes, when you go to that website, mmadnow.org, what you will see is some of the projects we've done. You'll see our mission statement. You'll see a link to have people reach out to us, as you just mentioned. You'll see a phone number. You'll see names of individuals on the website there that can help immediately. And you'll also see there's two ways to give if someone chooses to donate. One is through the website itself directly, which is a PayPal arrangement, and the other is through the Live Give. So the Live Give website, and we got a lot of support last year, a lot of participation for our first year on Live Give, but this is a year-round thing. So those are the two ways that people can donate if they choose to do so, and we certainly appreciate that.
Yeah. What if anybody out there, men listening, that may want to be part of the organization, is that available as well?
Great. Absolutely. That's why I love your interviewing. That's a perfect example as well of how we've been able to grow. We'll have people who hear about us and they have contributed their money, time, effort, people, their painting companies, handymen who have worked and do work here in the community, and they've said, hey, I want to be part of that, so we will help you. Well, that's great, but we right now don't have enough projects to send them to. So thank you.
Okay. Looking for projects, so if anybody needs a little bit of help, they know what to do. Tom, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I'd like to, other than express my gratitude and appreciation, admiration and respect for you personally, professionally, and KPCW. You guys do a great work and help spread the love in Park City.
Okay, Tom, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Savage, the Vice President of Men Making a Difference, an organization, again, that helps individuals who are not being served by others. And if you know of anybody, please give them shoot them an email.